I want to welcome you all to this panel discussion on politics and the media with some of Australia's best journalists under the auspices of the University of Melbourne's Centre for Advanced Journalism. My name is Michael Gawenda and I'm the director of the centre. We meet today on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. The title of this panel discussion is Politics and Journalists, Adversaries or Bedfellows. This event follows the public lecture last week by the former Prime Minister John Howard, and the panellists, I'm sure, will want to address some of the issues raised by Mr. Howard, though, of course, I do not expect them to confine themselves only to the issues that he raised. Now, at a time when the so-called mainstream media, and by that I mean newspapers and commercial television, not the ABC, because the ABC has got a very fine business model funded by all of us, is facing major economic challenges, I think it's important to reflect on the role of journalists in covering politics and government. I believe that when we talk of the threats to quality journalism, and there's a lot of talk about those threats at the moment, one of the main things we are talking about is the threat to robust and accurate and lively coverage of national politics. But at a time like this, it is more important than ever, in my view, for journalists and editors and executive producers to discuss with the community, people here tonight, and the wider community, the strengths and weaknesses of political reporting. Indeed, I think it's important that we discuss with the community, journalists, the strengths and weaknesses of all the work of the media and all the work of journalists. We journalists cannot afford to be too inward-looking, too smug about the quality issues that are there in the community, the quality of our journalism, too deaf to what our readers and viewers and listeners in the community in general think about the job we are doing. I think we have to convince the community that what we do is vital to the health of our liberal democracy, and over and above that, we have to convince the community that what we do, the quality of what we do, is worth saving and supporting. You will see over here there are flyers for the Centre for Advanced Journalism, which sets out the goals of the centre. There's also a form where you could register your email address so that if you've got an interest in the work of the centre, please take one of the flyers, and if you wish, register your interest in being in touch with the centre. Our hope is that the centre will develop a relationship with the general community that will enhance our mutual understanding of the work of journalists and the role the media plays in our liberal democracy. More than that, these public events and all the research projects undertaken by the centre have the goal of helping to improve the practice of journalism in Australia and beyond in our region. And just as importantly, to give the community, people here and others, a chance to offer journalists feedback on their work. Let me now introduce the panel. They will each speak for around 10 minutes, after which we will have questions from you, the audience. Alan Kohler, as our flyer makes clear, is a former editor of the Australian Financial Review and The Age. He is the publisher and editor-in-chief of Eureka Report and Business Spectator. Alan has moved from old media to new media. I think Alan grasped what the future was about a long time before I did, and a long time before a lot of others did. So it's good to have him here today. He is also the chairman of Melbourne University Publishing, and really is one of our most distinguished and best known business and economic commentators. George Megalogenis is the author of Fault Lines and The Longest Decade and a senior journalist with the Australian newspaper. George spent 11 years in the Canberra Press Gallery between 1988 and 1999 before returning to the Australian's Melbourne Bureau. I think George is an absolutely outstanding reporter and commentator, and it's great to have him here tonight. Lee Sales anchors the Late Line program on ABC television Wednesday, Thursday and Friday nights. She was the ABC's Washington correspondent from 2001 to 2005. I first met Lee in Washington, and she helped me settle in and pointed me in the right directions, I think, in the main, not always. but in the main, she did that. She won a Walkley Award during her time in Washington for a coverage of Guantanamo Bay, and that coverage was absolutely superb. She is the author of two books, Detainee 002, The Case of David Hicks, and more recently, On Doubt. Paul Kelly is editor-at-large of The Australian. He has previously been editor-in-chief of the paper. He writes on Australian politics, public policy and international affairs, and is a regular commentator on the ABC's Insider program. I'm not sure that that does him total justice. I think Paul Kelly is probably the foremost political commentator in the country. And some of his books have been amongst the best written on politics in Australia. His forthcoming book, The March of Patriots, will be released by Melbourne University Press next month. There are flyers for the book on the table over there. I saw Louise Adler, the publisher, sitting there trembling to make sure that I mentioned that. Well, I have, Louise. The flyers are on the table over there for Paul's book, and it's great to have Paul with us tonight. So let me start by inviting Alan Kohler to start proceedings. Alan, you have the floor.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, well, I'm going to talk a little about John Howard's talk, and then I'll go off on some riffs of my own. But did everyone hear John Howard's speech or read it? Would it be helpful if I just quickly read through it? I've got it here. Just kidding. I won't do that. And I come at this subject with the benefit of not having been a political journalist. I've had to manage political journalists on a couple of occasions. But I kind of, I approach it, I guess, from the point of view of somebody from outside of Canberra. I think Howard made a couple of interesting points, which I thought were worth making, and what I found interesting. One was the shift in newspaper deadlines has, he says, increased the importance of morning radio and TV since papers are more out of date. I thought that was kind of, I hadn't heard that before, that was kind of interesting. There's no more talk of media concentration, which there was a few years ago. Obviously, nobody's talking about that anymore because the media is fragmenting and is under threat as a result. So that's an interesting observation. I don't think there was much else that was interesting in the speech. I guess the headlines are that journalists are all pinkos and were very horrible to Pauline Hanson and Peter Hollingworth. On the subject of left of centre journalists, and whether journalists are left of centre, I don't think that's a particularly blinding insight. And I think it's perfectly true, I guess, as a generalisation, as he says. I don't think it's especially interesting to say that. Journalism was not long ago was a fully unionised trade, has since, in the last decade or two, become professionalised. But the union still runs the awards, and it is still a, you know, I don't think it has made fully the transition to being what you might call a right-wing profession. So, and I don't think it's that significant what the sort of political leanings of journalists are. But Mr. Howard's comments did get me thinking about the tribalism of politics, which I had occasion recently to observe at close hand when I attended the launch of the Tony Abbott's book last week as chairman of MUP. And I don't often get the chance to mix in political circles in that way, particularly right-wing political circles, but... and I was so struck by the sense of that the world is divided into friends and enemies among politicians, not just right-wing politicians or, you know, conservative politicians, but I guess all politicians. And it's not surprising, if you think about it, that that should occur, because what other job is there where there's somebody else whose job it is to constantly oppose you and to point out your flaws? I mean, there is no other walk of life in which that happens. So, if you think about it, it's inevitable that politicians will divide the world into friends and enemies in that way, and that they'll tend to do the same to the journalists who surround them, as journalists tend to. I mean, I'm a business journalist, and you know, business journalists get very close to business people as well. And sports journalists get very close to sporting people. All journalists get very close to their subjects, including police and so on. There's a very small category of journalists who remain aloof from that. They're kind of general reporters who come into work each day and get assigned by the chief of staff to a job that particular day, and it could be, and they don't know what it's going to be, and they're just kind of journeyman journalists. And that's not, that's a fairly rare type of journalist. Most journalists are actually, you know, involved in mining a particular subject. So political journalists are, you know, a very common type of journalist. But it becomes very fraught because of this this syndrome that I'm talking about of the way that politicians view the world, which is entirely unique, it seems to me, to everybody else, because of the way that politics works, because there is this opposition, which means that, you know, everybody is either a friend or an enemy. And so the journalists tend to get divided up like that as well. And so I think that Mr. Howard's comments tend to reflect that, you know, that fact. My view of political journalism is mainly that it's guilty of superficiality. And that I'm, I suppose, disappointed that Mr. Howard didn't really get into that. And I'll talk about why that is in a moment. But my sort of view of political journalism from both, as both a consumer of it and occasional manager of it, is that too guilty, too often it's does just three things. Theatre reviews of the theatre of politics. Gaff watch, which is to constantly watch for the gaff. And the other thing, and the third thing, is arithmetic, which is counting the numbers. And the reason that John Howard doesn't complain about this is because superficiality is exactly what he and the other politicians want. And everything that John Howard did, and the way he lived his life, the way he engaged the media, the way he used talkback radio, it seems to me was designed to encourage superficiality in the reporting of his activities. And so that, I think, came through his speech. I think that it's the problem with political journalism. It's the fact that too much journalism is superficial and not not sufficiently inquiring and sceptical. John Howard used the phrase sceptical and talked a bit about that, but only in relation to the fact that he prefers that to cynicism. But too little journalism is sufficiently inquiring, I think, and that's one of the reasons it's in trouble. I mean, you know, journalism has always been subsidised by advertising, whether it's the broadsheets or the tabloids. It's subsidised by advertising. People have never had to pay the full price for it. And it's now that the problem of paying the full price for the journalism is looming, people are finally, I think, discovering that it's kind of not worth the sort of price that might have to be paid. Just to conclude, I think that Mr. Howard's analysis is superficial, but in line with the sort of journalism that he prefers. Thank you.
George?
Thank you, Alan, and thank you, Michael. There wasn't a very interesting... One of the things that did stand out in the speech was this mention of the news cycle switching from the afternoon to the morning, which I'll come to in a minute, which Alan's already pointed to. The other interesting thing that John Howard said to my eyes and ears was that his default career would have been journalism. So, in a sense, journalism was his second team after politics. And it struck me that every Prime Minister I've covered, and I am still relatively young in this game, Bob Hawke was the first Prime Minister I covered in Canberra. I moved to Canberra in 1988, as Michael mentioned in the introduction, so I've covered Hawke, Keating, Howard and Rudd. Now, each of them did fancy themselves as a journalist. They fancied themselves in the way that might surprise, I think, the regular political junkie. They think that they could do our job better than we can. Well, that stands to reason, because we're covering them, so they think they know their subject matter better than we do. But the interesting thing about them is that they fancy themselves as political commentators and editors. They would like to be able to tell us how to better run our products. And that is not in the sort of most superficial observation that everything about them should be right, but they're actually political junkies in a much more detailed way. They have a number of ideas about how to cover not just the topic that is them, but every other topic known to man and woman. And I thought what I'd do is maybe turn this idea on its head and rate each of them as journalists and see what sort of journalists they might have made. I'll assume that each of them got their start as print cadets at the old Melbourne Sun News Pictorial. And firstly, Hawke, I imagine, would have arrived as a graduate cadet, obviously a Rhodes Scholar, and he would have been the first in his intake to get his byline on the front page, quite confident of that. He would have skipped shorthand classes, but convinced the teacher to give him a pass so he could secure his grading. I'd give him 2 years maximum on the tabloid before he was poached for an on-air reporting job on 60 Minutes. Paul Keating would have been a copy kid at the Melbourne Sun, having not completed high school before he chanced on journalism. He would have done his cadetship on the business desk, rising quickly to the job of economics editor, a position, incidentally, he would have advised the paper to create for him, because they wouldn't have thought of it before he turned up. Now, we've got editors either side of me, and I hope each of them don't think I'm projecting here, but Keating would have been the most difficult journalist on the paper, refusing to accept even the most subtle guidance from his editor. I'm sometimes accused of that internally, that I am quite difficult, only because I push back on some ideas that are given to me. But anyway, be that as it may, I'd see Keating not as a kindred spirit, but just as a very difficult operator. I think where Hawke would have felt the paper was too small for him and needed a grander stage, and where Keating would have thought that everyone above him and below him on the paper was beneath him, I think John Howard would have landed in journalism on day one feeling very privileged to have got the job, because I think he did make this point in his speech that it was his second love after politics. But I think he would have eyed the reporting floor and thought, not reporting for me, the chief of staff's job. He would have headed straight for the greasy pole, probably got there quicker than people expected, and probably fallen. And at that point, I think, and this is the interesting thing about him, if we do view him as a journalist, I think he would have returned to first principles, probably diligently built up his areas of knowledge, maybe as a rounds person, and then probably found his voice not in print but on talkback radio as a surprise number one rating talk show host. I wouldn't say shock jock. Now, Kevin Rudd. The interesting thing about Kevin Rudd is he has turned up to everything in life fully formed. He would have remained on staff, not done what Bob Hawke did and switched platforms. He would have set up his own blog on day one, made himself available to radio and TV as a commentator on any topic. And because The Sun only ran a six-day roster, it published Monday to Saturday, there was a seventh day that he clearly couldn't take off, so he volunteered for something he knew nothing about, which was calling the footy. And he picked the ABC's footy coverage over the 3AW or the FM radio stations because the callers that would ring back after 5 o'clock would give him tips for the next day when he went back into the office at the Sun. Now, I'll leave it to you all to work out how each of them became editor, how much blood was on their hands and what ultimately killed their time at the top. Now, as Alan mentioned, there was a very, very interesting observation from John Howard as a practitioner of media, as a user of the medium, that he called it the shift from afternoon to morning. And he says in the 15 to 20 years before he'd become Prime Minister, something like the PM program was more of more value to him, say, than the morning news cycle, because a politician could do an interview on PM, the newspaper deadline was late enough for it to appear on the front page of the next day's paper. Now, politicians are always looking for multiple bangs for their media appearance. You notice now people do the morning shows because they know that through the day the media cycle is going to keep up to date with what it is they started that morning. The way politics works now, no one expects a story to run for more than 24 hours, if that. The things that run for more than 24 hours are the very big stories. And those are the stories that politicians want to avoid because it's usually something that has a momentum outside of their control. Now, I think we've got to give them credit as a user of the media to have noticed the switch. Now, I've been digging through some old papers just to remind myself that the deadlines have moved in the way that they have. One of the most famous interviews in his first incarnation as opposition leader that John Howard gave was to the PM program on August the 1st, 1988, where he effectively ad-libbed the coalition's immigration policy and suggested that the rate of Asian migration should be slowed in the interests of social cohesion. Now, I have checked that the Australian ran it on the front page the next day, August the 2nd, which it did. Paul Kelly has his comment across the top of the front page, and they point to a straight and a very long reported piece on page 3. The reason why that's interesting is that clearly the operation of the deadline of the Australian in those days was late enough for John Howard to appear on PM and not only for the interview to be heard, that meant that everybody was listening to it in the press gallery, but for people to then be able to turn around front page coverage and an inside story on that. Now, the next example, and I'm going to connect the two because John Howard did talk a bit about Pauline Hanson and how the media gave her a bad rap. I had to remind myself, again, I've gone back through to the front page. Now, it was my memory, and my memory did serve me well, that Pauline Hanson didn't get front page coverage for the maiden speech she gave to Parliament on September 10, 1996. And in fact, The Australian had a couple of paragraphs on a related story on the front page, and then a small story down page on page 2, which is just down here. And the most interesting story on page 2 that day was we, as a newspaper, and I think Paul might have been editor-in-chief at the time, confessed that somehow we lost Duncan Armstrong's gold medal, which he just won at the Atlanta Olympic Games. We, the paper, didn't lose it. The courier that we had returned the gold medal to had lost it en route back to Duncan Armstrong's place.
Thanks for reminding me.
Now, again, there's a different lesson here. That speech was given early afternoon. Everybody watched it in the press gallery, and my vivid recollection is that everybody had a very strong opinion on it, but it wasn't rated as page one news. This is an example. Pauline is an example of something that jumped the normal containment lines of political reporting. The story started somewhere else. Obviously, a proportion of the Australian electorate heard what she'd said, even though they didn't consume it through the regular media. It wasn't on our front page, for example. And it took 12 days before we got her on the front page, and only then she was on the front page because John Howard had defended her right to free speech. Now, that was a good week and a half's worth of controversy, which began not necessarily in the Parliament, because most people chose to ignore her in the first few days in Parliament, not necessarily in the traditional media, because most people thought, well, some of these comments are a bit red hot, we might let them go, or we might just see how this thing pans out. Her medium was talkback radio, and this is the thing that John Howard was able to come back to the second time in his career. No, talkback radio did him in the first time around in 88, when we all had time to dissect his comments on the PM program. He'd returned as a much more articulate voice on talkback radio through the 90s. He was less prone to thinking out aloud. He was much more disciplined in the messages that he sent across that medium. But that didn't mean that he could control the public conversation, because the public conversation, obviously, in the 90s veered into all sorts of directions with Hansenism and related matters. Now, again, I'll just make these points. The 90s are considered the glory days the good old days when we all had time on our hands. We didn't really have time on our hands then any more than we do today. It's just that news could be received in different ways. Now, I'll just take you through a couple of points. I'm just going to hurry this up because I know I've written a couple of more pages than I need to read out. I'll just give you an idea of how my job has changed in the last 20-odd years, because I went to Canberra as a 24-year-old in 1988 with a background in economics, a degree at Melbourne University, sort of landed without any warning in the economics correspondence job for the News Limited morning papers, which in those days was The Sun, The Telegraph, The Advertiser in Adelaide, the Brisbane Courier Mail, and of course we had the Hobart Mercury in the group. So I would be writing for roughly 2 million readers a day, which sounds quite impressive, but in those days all you were doing was beer sigs up, interest rates up or down. It was a fairly rudimentary, even for the tabloid, even though there was big economic reform debates going on in the 80s. Now, I think back to the first federal election campaign I covered in 1990, and I wonder about, and again I was looking through the records, I wonder about what it was that we had in those days to inform us about how maybe an election campaign might travel, how people felt about the respective parties, what marginal seats were at play. We didn't really have that much to go on in those days. You'd call both sides of politics, get a feel for what seats they thought were important. You're out on the road, so you did when you could take the opportunity to leave the bus and start talking to some punters. You did have a bit of time on your hand to read everything that everybody else had said. And you file your stories for the next day's paper. But really, it was partly gut call and it was partly just a static view of Malcolm McCarris's pendulum. There was no sophistication in how you would cover something like an election campaign other than just reporting and interpreting the events of the day. Now, just think back to this last election campaign. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the sort of angle I took at that election campaign. I spent the first half of 2007, now this is a comment on where I see the glass half full in terms of the digital age. I spent the first half of 2007 basically in some fairly interesting negotiations with the Bureau of Statistics to see if I can get my hands on raw data for each marginal electorate, 150 federal electorates, because the census was going to come out in the middle of that year. Now just think about where a journalist is when they get a jump like that on everybody else in the game. I had information across all seats, across all voting types, across all household incomes, working, not working. In fact, I still haven't crunched all the tables that I got my hands on. I had things that the political parties didn't have. Now, of course, once you get this information, you do one of two things. You could try and hoard it, which doesn't last too long, because all your competitors are going to be onto your game very quickly and they're going to be mining the same data source. Or you do what I did in my case, put as much as I could in the first two or three editions of The Australian after they were released to me, and then dump the lot on the blog. Dump the lot on our website and basically let a trillion flowers bloom to see who else could cut and paste this data, reinterpret it. Now, the thing for me, there was always a risk that I'd missed a dozen stories out of my own material. But this was the thing that you need to do now in our game. If you're going to go live, whether it's on a website or you're going to be offering some extra information, you need something that nobody else has in the first instance, and then you should be in a position to interpret it. Now, that may be a rare event, but the reason why I mention it is today, the information sources at my disposal as a journalist are exponentially superior to what they were 10 and 20 years ago. I may have had time then to interpret everything that came across my desk. I may have had time then to read every transcript of not just Prime Minister, Opposition Leader, but Treasurer, Shadow Treasurer. I plead guilty. I do not read everything that Kevin Rudd says in the media, and I pretty much stop reading outside of election campaigns what John Howard did in the media. I read a lot of it, but I can't read all of it. I just don't have enough time in the day to do all that. One of the reasons for that is not just that they're in the media more often than they were, say, in the 80s and the 90s. It's just that there's other stuff out there that the internet and other vehicles allow me to play with, which are infinitely more interesting to me than the right lines of a politician. Now, like I say, I think this is a glass half full observation I make, but the problem to get to this point is you need a good deal of experience. And the question, and I think the question for some of you who are studying journalism in the next few years, is how you get yourself into a position to be able to tap what's out there now, because the information itself is daunting in one respect. Those who can interpret this information are going to have a pretty good career path if they're willing to slug it out. But you can't just go in there at once over easy. And the stuff that Alan talked about the once over easy, say, a lot of political journalism, we're in a position now, just through the blogosphere, where most people are going to reinterpret what we write. Most people are going to reinterpret what has just come out in that day's opinion polling. Most people are going to reinterpret the data that I've interpreted. Most people are going to call me out on a number I might have got wrong, or call me out on an interpretation I've got wrong. I don't think that's such a bad thing, but to be able to face the great mass that is the digital media, and to be able to face your audience, readers, viewers, you've got to be in a position to tell them something they don't know, and I don't think that that is ever going to change in our craft, profession, whatever it is we like to call it. I think the times ahead are pretty exciting, but I'm also conscious of the fact that when media is changing, some people in our game call them platforms, I don't like that phrase, it is journalism in the end, but I think the adaptability across a number of media is really the thing that will test us in the future. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael, for inviting me to speak. And I just want to make it clear, when he says that I steered him in the right direction, I think he means towards Washington's best bookshops and cafes. And I don't want anyone thinking I'm the type of person that, when the editor of The Age arrives to take up a posting, that I presume to give them advice about how to go about doing journalism. I found John Howard's speech interesting, and I'm glad I had the chance to mull over it, mainly because he's obviously spent a lot more time on the other side of the microphone than I have. So it was sort of interesting to me to hear his thoughts, mainly to see if I could glean anything about what's in the politician's trick bag to then sort of use in my job. I thought what I'd do tonight is pick up on some of his comments that most struck me, whether I agreed with them or not, and then elaborate from there. So my remarks will be a little bit bits and piecey, but if there's something that you want to ask me about, you know, please feel, and I don't raise it in the speech, please feel free to ask me afterwards. Mr. Howard noted the need, as Alan said, for scepticism in journalism, but he made the distinction between scepticism and cynicism. And I think that's a very important distinction for any journalist. As Michael said, I've recently written this essay called On Doubt for MUP's series Little Books on Big Themes, and it's pretty much all about the need for sceptical minds, particularly in journalism. I think that good journalism relies on approaching a story with an open mind, with the sort of attitude that says, I don't know everything and I'm here to learn, rather than I'm already certain that my own views are right and I'm going to interpret this story or the talent's views through that prism. So given that that's my view, I'm a little alarmed at what I see as a trend towards certainty in journalism rather than scepticism. And I note this particularly in the creeping influence of opinion into mainstream news reporting, or the emphasis on opinion at the expense of straight reporting. A lot of the public debate is dominated not by factual news or features, but by the interpretation and analysis of the facts by opinionated broadcasters or columnists. Often the columnists and opinion makers who attract the most attention and therefore have the most impact on the debate seem to me to be the ones who can shout the loudest and throw more inflammatory invective than anybody else. Some opinion writing and commentary in Australia is very impressive and sheds genuine light, and I would think that everyone at this table is offering that type of reportage. But the worst opinion writing in Australia is more concerned, I think, with point scoring than with educating audiences. Some commentators play to their own cliques, neglecting the wider public. They tend to exaggerate the facts or selectively highlight those that support their own positions while conveniently ignoring those that don't. They don't realise or perhaps care that in overstating an argument they undermine it. Opponents' views are taken out of context or subtly distorted. And any error, no matter how tiny, is magnified in an attempt to discredit the whole. Thoughtful opinion writers, both liberal and conservative, occasionally disagree with those of the same stripe. But the journalism that bothers me toes the ideological line unswervingly, regardless of the contortions of logic that it requires. As the polemicist Hendrik Hertzberg once wrote, a political ideology is a very handy thing to have. It's a real time saver because it tells you what to think about things you know nothing about. Some commentary can also display a striking lack of civility. It's not enough to politely disagree. Opponents have to be ridiculed and personally vilified and treated as genuine enemies. It's part of that tribal sort of tendency that Alan spoke of. To write or broadcast like that, a person has to have real moral certitude. And I think that attitude is often incompatible with good journalism. It can make for good writing, it can make for a persuasive argument or for passionate advocacy. But to me, it's not journalism. I think that a journalist needs to be sceptical, not just about everything around him or her and the stories they're reporting on, but also about him or herself and about their own opinions and what they're bringing into stories that they're covering. So that leads me to cynicism. Scepticism can sometimes curdle into cynicism, and that's something that a journalist has to resist. Skepticism involves probing or testing an interviewee's viewpoints, but it can become a world-weary cynicism if you always assume that everybody has base motives, if you think the worst of everything, if you think there's always a conspiracy at play rather than a stuff-up. I think that people do, or in my experience, you know, in sort of 15 plus years of reporting, people do warm to you if they sense that you've come to a story with an open mind and that you are genuinely interested in what they have to say. If you approach with cynicism or with a sort of certainty in your own attitude, I think that closes people up. So there is a blend somewhere on the continuum between scepticism and cynicism where you're not a complete rube and you're not having the wool pulled over your eyes, but you're also prepared to give people the benefit of the doubt and have an open mind. In the past couple of years, I've moved from on the road or out in the field reporting to almost entirely studio-based journalism with a few occasional forays back into reporting. It's a very different type of journalism, but I try to bring the same sensibility to it that I took to my field reporting, which is that I'm trying to facilitate to get the talent to tell their story and to get their point of view across so the audience can learn and understand what they're trying to say. That fits in a little bit with the theme of John Howard's speech about whether politicians and journalists are bedfellows or adversaries. At the end of the day, what I'm trying to do in any interview is to get the interviewee to answer questions that I think are in the public interest or that the public would be interested in, or that the public might find useful. So if I'm interviewing a politician and the politician's engaging on that level and answering the questions and trying to explain things, then I would say that in that encounter, we're bedfellows. Where perhaps we become adversaries is where the politician isn't engaging properly in the interview, is sidestepping questions or sticking only to the party spin or just willfully peddling misinformation, as sometimes happens. So just because I'm facilitating somebody to try to get their point of view across, it doesn't mean that they get to do that unchallenged. Their point of view has to be able to stand up to challenges and they have to be able to respond to that. One of the things I hear the most complaints about from viewers is politicians not answering questions. And I'm sure you all know the sort of thing I'm talking about. It's where I say, Minister, what did you have for breakfast? And she says, well, for lunch I had a salad sandwich. And I interrupt and I say, I'm not asking what you had for breakfast, I'm asking what you had for lunch. And she says, Lee, if you just let me finish, for lunch I had a salad sandwich and for dinner I had a steak. And then I say, you're still not answering the question. What did you have for breakfast? And then she'll say, Lily, with all due respect, breakfast is not the issue. The issue is lunch. And for lunch, I had a salad sandwich. Now, that is a common technique that politicians use all the time to avoid answering questions they don't want to answer. They just ignore what they've been asked and then they simply tell you what they wish to tell you. And I'm really not sure why they do it, because if the correspondence I get from viewers is anything to go by, they see through it. And I think that viewers assume that either the question is too difficult or the politician has something to hide. So it strikes me as a fairly counterproductive technique. In his speech last week, John Howard said that one of the things a politician has to do is to be prepared to front up, not only when things are going well, but also when things are going badly. And in my experience, John Howard did actually do that when he was in politics. He would always front up. It's something that I admire because it's not easy and it's something that not all politicians do. Of the people who come on Late Line frequently, if you sort of pay attention, Tony Abbott and Lindsay Tanner are people who are pretty good at coming on all the time, good or bad days, and trying their best to put their own case. I think the value for politicians who do that is that it can be persuasive, because anyone can persuade an audience that he or she is right when it's a good day for them or when it's an easy question. It's much harder to win over an audience who may not be on side. When John Howard talks about using talkback radio or the internet because you can reach people directly with your message without a gatekeeper, that is true. But I wonder if the sort of people that you reach in those spheres are perhaps people who, you know, the sort of people who will listen uninterrupted to a John Howard monologue on the radio or read right to the end of a John Howard article are perhaps people who are already on side. I'd suggest that a politician who sits down with me or Chris Uhlman or David Spears and is challenged on what he or she says and is able to mount a persuasive case in the face of that scrutiny is far more likely to attract over viewers or listeners who might not have been predisposed to that viewpoint in the first place. John Howard said he was unapologetic about trying to present news about his government in a way that delivered maximum positive returns. For example, leaking material to a friendly journalist or going on a friendly radio program. And I don't think that he should be apologetic about that, because politicians are perfectly entitled to try to use the media to their advantage and to learn about our practices to try to best get their message out. And as journalists, we need to expect that. But I think what we as journalists need to do is expose that strategy and point out to our readers and viewers and listeners what the government is doing. I know when politicians come on my program and they won't answer the question or they keep repeating the same mantra, I don't mind sort of pulling back the curtains and exposing the sort of machinations of what's going on. So saying to people, okay, you know, George, you've made the point that Kevin Rudd is an idiot now three times. Let's not make that point again. Let's move on. Da-da-da-da-da, and try to negate it in that way. Or I will say, you know, you've not answered the question, and the reason I'm going to ask it again is because I think my viewers would like to know A, B, C, D, E, because I feel that that flags to viewers that the minister or whoever it is dodging the question if they've not already noticed. But I think it also flags to the minister or the politician that they're not only just ignoring me or dissing my questions, they're also engaged not only in a discussion with me but in a discussion with hundreds of thousands of potential voters. The final thing I'll just say is that I think Alan is dead right when he talks about that because there's such tribalism in politics, they assume that there's a similar sort of tribalism in journalism. And in my experience, that's just not the case. I think, you know, some journalists, of course, are very interested in politics and are quite political. But there's a hell of a lot of journalists I know or people in my own newsroom that just aren't that interested in politics. And I think the assumption that if someone's not as far to the right as you, therefore they're of the left, is just blatantly wrong. And it's sort of a false dichotomy that's often set up. So that's my reflections, and I'll hand over to Paul.
Thanks, Michael. It's very good to be at Melbourne University. I've been talking to John Howard about the media ever since 1974. And when I read the speech he gave last week, I only wish that he'd actually say more about what he really thinks and draw more upon his own experiences. As George said, Paul Keating and John Howard were both media junkies, but they were media junkies of a different type, divided by, I think, generation. Keating was obsessed about ideas, and Keating kept newspaper files of what he considered to be all the significant articles written in particular about himself during his entire parliamentary career. These were fantastic files. Occasionally, I'd persuade him to give them to me because they were fantastic resource documents. But Keating was interested in ideas and strategy and talking to the quality print media to try and shape the debate. And a great tragedy befell him, and that tragedy was the 24-hour media cycle. Paul hated the 24-hour media cycle, the idea of having to get out of bed early in the morning and get on radio and start setting the day's media agenda. He couldn't stand that. He hated the political advisers who told him he had to do it. And in that sense, in his lifetime, particularly when he was Prime Minister, if you like, contemporary politics and the media demands of contemporary politics move beyond him. Howard was different. Howard was not a born-to-rule liberal. Howard had no trouble talking to journalists. He was very familiar with journalists. He was always available. He was always accessible. I felt, in the end, too available and too accessible. He was very professional about it, would deal with journalists on the phone, his wife unfailingly polite at the dozens of phone calls that came into their home in Sydney when Howard was treasurer, always available for lunch or dinner, didn't give a lot away, but try to shape your thinking. And Howard made a very careful study of media outlets and individual journalists, and as Prime Minister, transformed the nature of the office by developing the most elaborate media and communication strategy any Prime Minister has ever had. Rudd follows Howard. And the real break in terms of media strategy is between Keating and Howard. So as I said, I don't want to be limited just by what Howard said. I want to make a few big picture comments tonight and then drill down a little bit into political journalism. I want to stress that while the media appears to be in control, it's not the way it seems. The media at the moment is undermined by three great revolutions. A technological revolution, and remember, technology is driving outcomes. Whether it's the short TV grab, whether it's the fact that print profitability is being undermined, whether it's the empowering of the internet, technology is changing outcomes. It's changing the way politics is being reported. The second revolution is a commercial one. The media is engaged in this mad scramble now for readers, viewers, listeners, and the advertising dollar. So this is driving all sorts of issues from celebrity culture to the intersection between journalism and entertainment, and the quest above all for media impact. The third revolution is a cultural one. We're confused about our culture and values, and the media is caught up in this contestability of values. So whether you're talking now about whether euthanasia should be legalised, what do you think of gay marriage, what do you think of the moral foundations of the Afghanistan war, how do we adjust society in an age of terrorism, the community and individuals are divided about these issues, and the media is also divided. We are confused about standards, and we are confused about journalism and how journalists ought to approach these issues. So I guess the other point about the modern media is we're getting more diversity. Old media is subject to competition from a host of new media. I think this is good because I think diversity as such is good, but we need to be careful because the problem is that a lot of the new media is very highly subjective, not very professional, typically partisan, and are prone to conspiracy theories. The modern age of politics sees a much more intense and prolonged interaction between politicians and journalists. As far as the politicians are concerned, the media is much more important. So looking at politics in the age of Howard or Tony Blair or Kevin Rudd, there's no comparison between the way they operate and the way someone like Robert Menzies operated when he was Prime Minister. Now, if you want to read a fascinating speech about the media, read Tony Blair's speech of the 12th of June 2007, a speech that caused a firestorm in Britain. One of the things Blair said was that as Prime Minister of Great Britain, a vast aspect of his job today, as big as anything else, and I quote, is coping with the media, its sheer scale, weight, and constant hyperactivity. At points, it literally overwhelms. Talk to senior people in virtually any walk of life today. Business, military, public services, sport, even charities and voluntary organisations, and they will tell you the same. People don't speak about it because in the main they are afraid to, but it is true nonetheless. And those who have been around long enough will also say it's changed significantly in past years. Now, as I said, Howard and Rudd represent politicians geared to the media age. And they spend a fantastic amount of their time on media strategy. So I think this is important in terms of looking at the way political journalism is changing. Let me go into some of this in a bit of detail. Governments set agendas. Governments have got the resources. The government is setting the agenda, and these days the media tends to follow. The media might think they're setting the agenda. I think more often than not, the media is following the government in terms of the 24-hour media cycle. Secondly, the media is overwhelmed by on-the-record comments. There is so much on the record from the politicians, the media has very little chance to drill down and work out what is happening below the surface. The media is drowning with on-the-record comments. Thirdly, political coverage is too much about tactics. In her Deakin lecture of 05, Michelle Grattan said, and I quote because she's got it dead right, "Almost everything that happens in Canberra is seen in straight political terms. It is not a case of what does this announcement mean, that is mean for the country, mean for the public interest, mean for the people, but what does it mean politically?" Unquote. Now that is the reality, and this is a distortion at work in the media, a distortion which is institutionalised in the media. We are too obsessed about what everything means in political terms, and that means that you lose any sense about what the true value of events are. I think that we're good at covering politics, but we're not good at covering governments. And governments are what counts. That's where the power is. And in that sense, the media tends to be too superficial. Covering government is very difficult. You can only cover government if you've got reporters who are on top of the issue, who are specialists, who penetrate, who get on top, who analyse, who put governments under pressure. Covering governments is difficult. Covering politics, frankly, is pretty easy. Now, the media is under a lot of pressure these days because of government's capacity to control resources and with its almost limitless ability to spin. And I think the media has not responded well to this challenge from government. We need to put governments under more pressure to be more transparent in the public interest where they should be transparent. And this starts, above all, with the way public funds are spent, with the way all the billions of dollars are spent in terms of government programs. And, you know, this is a great source of stories. Some parts of the media do it well, but this has got to be our bread and butter because this is the essence of the public interest and it's the essence of media responsibility. I think that we need to be aware that government is going to put media under a lot more pressure. If Rudd is a long-term Prime Minister, he is really going to start putting the media under pressure. There are lots of signs of this already. Look at the comment the Attorney General, Robert McClellan, made the other day about we need protocols with the media in terms of handling these national security stories. I think we need to bear in mind that the power of the executive government has politicised the whole system. That's the lesson of Children Overboard. The public service is much more politicised, the ADF was politicised, and journalists and the media need to be extremely professional in handling and coping with this challenge. Now, I think that what we need to do in particular is to bear in mind some of the great challenges that we do face. And bear in mind the mistakes we make. Now, one of Blair's critiques of the media, and I think he essentially got this right, is that the media is obsessed about impact. And the reason it's obsessed about impact goes to the revolutions I talked about at the start. This is what Blair said, talking about the media. Impact is what matters. It is all that can distinguish, can rise above the clamour, can get noticed. Impact gives competitive edge. Of course, the accuracy of a story counts, but it's secondary to impact. Scandal or controversy beats ordinary reporting hands down. News is rarely news unless it generates heat, as much as or more than light. Now, I think there's a lot in those comments, and I think the media need to think about that. The other thing we need to do is we need to reflect more on this growing incapacity we have just to identify mistakes. Identifying mistakes is not enough. Exposing injustice is not enough. We've got to go to character, judgment, start moralising, pretend we're secular priests. This is an absolute obsession. And listening to some journalists, you think that they were moralists rather than journalists. I respect journalists who can penetrate, who can disclose information. I don't particularly respect journalists who want to get on their hobby horse and pretend they're moralists. The other point I want to make is that John Howard said in his speech that he thinks journalists were very influenced over the past generation by Vietnam and the Whitlam dismissal. Well, Vietnam maybe, certainly not the Whitlam dismissal, but Watergate has been a template, not always good. Watergate has inspired journalists, and I think that's very good, but it's also cultivated the idea of the journalist as the hero, the politician as the crook. Now, I think that in Howard's speech, he made some interesting comments, and what I'd say is we need to be able to balance them. We need to be able to balance them between the good and the bad. Take Hansen. What he said about the media and Hansen is right. Pauline Hanson was elected to federal parliament by accident. She was an independent who served one term, and the Australian media made her the most famous politician in the world. In the world. I travelled a lot in those days. I'd go to New York, Bangkok, Paris. Every capital I went to, Pauline Hanson was the most famous Australian politician. That was the Australian media lacking a sense of balance and responsibility. On the other hand, Howard is wrong when he says that the media got carried away and felt that the Hanson issue was just about race. It wasn't just about race, but it was about race, and the media was right to identify the racial and moral issue and take a stand on it. So you've got to look at the balance. Exactly the same applies to Peter Hollingworth. Hollingworth, I think in retrospect we can see, did not have the qualities required to be a successful Governor General. The media got onto that. The media identified aspects in his past. They wrote those stories. Those stories were quite properly written. And the weaknesses in Hollingworth and the failure of the government to conduct due diligence was exposed. That's correct. On the other hand, Howard is also correct to say that the media went feral on this issue. They went totally over the top. We had journalists demanding that the Prime Minister sack the Governor General, a completely irresponsible position. It would have done grave damage to Australia's system of governance, and Howard had the sense to ensure that the solution was procured by the Governor General's resignation, not the Governor General's dismissal. My last comment, climate change. I think, again, it's a question of balance. The media has done well to run hard on this issue and identify the scientific basis of climate change and the need for action. The media has done badly on this issue because it has not been sufficiently professional and sceptical. It's operated too much as a crusader, too much as a believer. When journalists start to operate as crusaders and believers, they are not serving the public interest in the right way. So I think that sense of balance is enormously important. Howard got it half right. He admitted the other half of the story.